Hi, welcome to BCI Cattle Chat. I'm Brad White, joined today by Bob Weber.
Hey, Brad.
How's it going today?
Well, I'm doing all right.
We're back to school, and everybody's starting into classes. Dr. Larson's not here today. He's actually teaching a class that we're working on together. We've got some of the students back in town, and they're going through a class, and these are veterinary students, learning a little bit about different issues that they'll encounter in rural practice. So there's a banker coming in. They're going to talk to some folks from different areas. They're going to work on some communication skills. So some of the other areas beyond just veterinary medicine to hopefully help them be successful as they go forward.
Yeah, that's awesome. The getting all those skill sets built before they actually go out in some rural community somewhere is really important.
So. Well, we give them a chance to practice, and so they get to practice their communication. We figure if they can communicate with Larson and I, they've
probably all right.
It's good. Today's episode, we're going to talk about the heritability of reproduction. This comes up frequently, and a lot of times I'll give a talk and talk about reproduction, and I'll say, well, how heritable is it? So that's going to be our question for you is, how heritable is it?
All right.
We'll also talk about picking bulls, and this is a topic that I think is a, and we're not going to get into the specifics, but we're just going to debate a little bit, purebred versus a composite or hybrid bull. And then finally, we're going to talk about prepping calves and our ranch for fall weaning, processing, getting the calves ready to go, and talk a little bit about cattle handling.
That'd be great.
But first, I want to jump into the reproductive heritability. This topic comes up. We go to meetings. We have debates with people about how, and people will say, my common answer is lowly.
Lowly.
and then people ask, well, like what? Like how much?
Yeah. So,
What do you think?
It depends is the right answer, or yeah, somewhat or modestly. I think it varies a lot depending on how you define the trait. And we know cow reproduction, and for that matter, male reproduction or male fitness are affected by both genetics and environment. And our traditional view is that, you know, reproductive traits on the cow side are lowly heritable, which means that, you know, environmental influence is huge. The interesting thing, though, is if you go through the literature and you can sort of think of these practical examples of situations where, you know, if the nutrient environment is pretty lush and you experience a low amount of reproductive failure, you don't have very much data to work with to start with, because all the cows made successful records. They had a calf, right? We would say, you know, variation in genetics has a low impact. You know, if you go to sort of a middle of the road or harsher environment where you do see some reproductive failure, it can be, you know, a function of either, you know, we didn't manage our two-year-old cows right in terms of nutrition, or something underlying in terms of genetic potential. They might be too big in terms of mature size, or lactation potential doesn't fit the production environment, something like that. And so we see variation and then we go, it's heritable. So I think a lot has to do with you know, the estimates we get is dependent a lot on both how many environments we sample, how big the populations are, and how extreme or how different those contemporary groups might be in terms of.
But you bring up a good point in that we often, and often when I get the question, how heritable is reproduction, I say relatively low. It's not like a musculoskeletal trait. But you, when you were just giving your explanation, you talked about the musculoskeletal trait of frame size, which is highly heritable, being tied into, because it directly affects reproduction, especially if my nutrition varies.
Yeah, I think one of the complexities of reproduction is it's if we think about did she calve or not, it's a binary outcome, but it's affected by lots and lots of things. So it's a really complicated trait, whereas if we think about growth to some defined endpoint, that's a lot more transparent.
Right? It's affected by nutrition.
Yeah, nutrition.
And then we can control a lot of that if we look at a feed yard environment.
Yeah, if we take, say, mature weight or mature height, heritability estimates typically 0.6s or 0.7s. Okay. So it's
so when
really
you throw,
easy
when you
to influence.
Throw those out, 0, not heritable, 1,
right.
Complete absolute heritability.
Yeah, I think coat color.
Is that
right?
Right.
Yep.
Okay. So you're saying musculoskeletal, some of those things, 0.6?
Yeah, so the mature weight, mature height ones are on the far end of high heritabilities. If we think about weaning weight or yearling weight, typically 0.2 to 0.4, depending on the breed and you know how that's modeled. So, and when we say that, we mean, you know, 20 to 40% of the variation we observe amongst individuals is due to genetics, and then you know, one minus that is the fraction the student of environment.
Yeah, so weaning rate, you said 0.2, so 20% there and 80% other stuff.
Yep. Yeah.
Okay. So what about our reproductive traits? Do you have numbers for those?
Yeah. So if we think about, you know, some of the measurements that we talk about in the industry today, things like heifer pregnancy, for example, would be in the upper teens, low 20s, depending on breed. Cow stability. So that's the length of, stability traditionally defined is, did she have a calf at 6 years of age, given she had a calf at two? So, back in the early 90s, it was put forth that, you know, a cow's break-even point in terms of her profitability is about age six. And so that seemed like a logical spot to measure. Did she make it to six or not? And
so that's stability. But let me brief sec. Is that still true? Do you think it takes till six till she breaks even, or is it over or under that?
I don't know. That's a good question. I've not thought about that. I suspect it's, yeah, that seems like a reasonable number to me, but
that would be
I'm biased.
Interesting, yeah. That would be an interesting poll question.
Yeah, that's a great idea.
When they think that
when
they
producers...
break even. And then we'll compare those thoughts. We'll get Dustin back on and have him actually do the economics.
Do the economics. That's a great idea. Get the economist here.
So, sorry, back to stability.
Yeah, stability.
So stability is if she's in the herd by six.
Yeah, is she in the herd at six or had a calf, made a calf record, so calf weaning weight at six, given she had a calf at two. And that heritability is somewhere in the typically low point twos. So, not particularly high, but not zero either. You know, other measures have been put forth that have differing heritability. So we can think about, measurements like ovulation rate, postpartum interval, so how long between calves, calving interval is another idea that's been put forward. The challenge, I think, with a lot of those is sort of defining the contemporary group. So understanding, you know, that cows are in a common parity. So as we collect data, we have to be pretty careful about how we kind of analyze that. And that makes it a little complicated because we can think about, you know, all of the cows that were put into production, calved, bred as yearlings in a common contemporary group, calved as two-year-olds, then three-year-olds, and then four-year-olds. And we collect data as we go along to try
it's
and inform.
It's hard to get enough data from the peer groups.
Yep.
If you boiled it down to a couple numbers that you wanted to look at, so we talked about stability, but if we wanted to look at reproduction, what would be some of the numbers you look at, and maybe do some of those have higher heritability than the stability?
Yeah, so I think, you know, one of the ones that's sort of evolved relatively recently is sort of the idea of stability, but looking at it in shorter time intervals. So did she calve at three given two? Did she calve at four given three? And so we get information early in a cow's life, because one of the challenges with stability is that by the time a sire gets proven for stability, well, it's 6 years before the cow makes a record, right?
Right.
So you had two more years between when that bull went into service and his first daughter's calved. So he's at least eight. He's probably more like 9 or 10 by the time he's proven. Well,
and then there are other traits that have already progressed.
Yeah, we're way past this bull. Yeah. We're a generation or two on to the next bulls. And so the time factor really plays a role in these in terms of data analysis. So some other things that are coming along, so this idea of changing stability to capture data early on, because we know, you know, if a cow fails as a two-year-old and we color, she's not going to make a record at six. We already, we got all the information out of that cow we're going to get. So using that earlier parity data makes sense. I'm working on preparing for a talk this weekend, actually, on cow reproduction, and had a really good conversation with Warren Snelling. He's a scientist at the Meat Animal Research Center at the BIF meeting, actually, over a cold beer at the bar, and we had a great conversation. And Warren and his colleagues have actually put a paper that was published this year in JAS that looked at some alternative measurements of reproductive expression. And two of them really sort of struck a chord with me because they're really intuitive and they're really simple. And if you know Warren, I mean, he's a really smart guy, but he's also cowboy practical. And so those two measurements are, one is cumulative calf age at weaning. So if we think about cows that do things that we like in terms of reproductive performance, they calve early at the calving, or calve early in the calving distribution, which means they got bred early in the breeding season, right? They're all things we like. And we know from data analysis perspective that the calves that are heaviest at weaning time were the ones, Brad, that were what?
Born early.
Born early, right? Absolutely. So this is great. The other measurement is cumulative pounds of calf weaned. So not adjusted for 205 constant age, which is a reflection of growth genetics, but actually how many pounds did this cow get across the scale as for weaned calves. And again, influenced by if she calves born. Early, right? Yeah. So turns out that the heritabilities for those two traits in the Meat Animal Research Center data, so about 20,000 some cows, production records, 0.4.
Wow.
So
higher than even our weaning weight that we talked about.
Right. Yep. And we've made, if you think about the genetic change, or sometimes hesitate to say progress, but the genetic change we've made in weaning weight over time is pretty substantial. The heritabilities in the 0.2s. How much improvement could we make in repro with a trait that's 0.4?
Well, and I think we've seen it because you'll see cow families, cow calves early, she has a heifer, you keep that heifer that was born early in the calving season, she's more likely to stay in the herd. And there are actually some biological, so beyond that we talked about the genetic and other stuff, so there's some biological reasons for that too. When we look physiologically after she calves, she's going to have a postpartum interval. And that's set by her body and what condition she's in at that time. So if she calves early, even if she has a problem, she can get bred back and still potentially be early in the calving season.
Yep. Yeah. She's got some cushion. Right?
So there's a plus plus. So when we think about genetics of fertility, there are some positives. There are some things that we could say, yeah, it's slowly heritable, but here's some other measures. And one of the things we talked about as kind of a take home, look at that cumulative number, non-adjusted, of both calf days of age and calf weaning weight.
Right.
Because the other part of the equation, and I want to kind of shift to talk about, so we talked a lot about the female side there.
Yep.
I want to talk about bulls, because, and I had this particular question this year as I was looking at bulls, and you say, the question is, and I think you and I visited a little bit about it at the time,
yep.
Should I get a hybrid or composite bull? Or should it get a purebred bull? And there's a little bit of pros and cons with both sides. What's your, and let me guess, you're going to say it depends.
It depends. It does. It does depend, right? Context is important here. Okay. So, yeah.
So let's take the, let me give you a specific commercial cow-calf, selling the calves at weaning. So I'm not feeding them all the way out. Really, reproduction and weaning weight are my two big things that I want to get.
Yep. So I'll ask you the same questions I ask my extension clients. How do you keep replacement females? Do you build those or do you purchase them off farm? And are we going to mate just mature cows or are we going to mate heifers?
Yes, keep replacements, and yes, mature cows and heifers.
Yep. So that helps sort of contextualize, are we in a sort of a balanced trait sort of selection strategy, or are we in a terminal selection strategy, or are we in exclusively a calving ease only kind of strategy? And that sort of directs us a little bit maybe into which territory.
So give me your thought process there. So let's say I'm terminal.
Yep.
You might lean more, if we have, and I may ask you to, because composite and hybrid, maybe define those two words for me, because they're a little bit different.
Synonyms? I think they're a little different. They get used a lot as synonyms out in by producers. I need a composite bull. Or I need a hybrid bull. As an animal breeder, I tend to keep those separate because they're sort of the result of different breeding strategies that make the inputs that go into them. So a composite can be, you can have a two-breed composite, so two breeds put together, but then what we call interse mated. So we take animals out of the F1 population and mate those together to make the F2s and subsequent populations or generations. Yeah. And so we've fixed the genetics going into that population and we mate amongst individuals within that group.
Okay.
So we just mate, we start off the first turn, we make F1s and then we mate those together to make the F2s. They stay 50-50 on average genetic composition. move forward.
Which is a lot of times what we think of in a like a cross traditional crossbred herd.
Right.
So if I'm a commercial herd, I've got cows of one type and bulls of a different type, and then
Put them together. So the composite is sort of this strategy of taking breeds, put them together, kind of think make your own breed, but from different breed inputs. So they might be a two breed or a three breed or a four breed composite. At the root, if you think about the American breeds, Brangus, Beefmaster, so forth, those are really composites. So we took a sampling of genetics at some point in time, crossed them, built them. And you can still put new genetics in if you go through the right process to get them to the right breed fractions. That's a composite.
Okay.
I use hybrid to really describe typically the F1s. So if you think about products like Sim Angus or Limflex or Balancer Bulls, a lot of those get made as mating two purebred parents together to make a half-blood or 50-50. That's kind of what I use for a hybrid. Because it's a very specific process of combining these purebred parents to make the hybrid or cross seed stock product that's going to go out in the market space.
Okay, so in my scenario, and you said the answer is going to vary a little bit, and you're not going to pick one of those for all scenarios, but in broad terms, you said maybe if it's a terminal, are you leaning more towards the composite hybrid or the purebred?
So the one thing we didn't ask is what your cows look like now. So if you've got crossbred cows, and they're, let's hypothetically, what breeds?
Hypothetically, they're black.
They're black. Okay, so they're black crossbred cows. The ubiquitous.
I know
ones.
That's uncommon.
No, that's all right. The two things to think about as we enter these crossbreeding discussions are sort of retained heterosis. So how do I keep crossbred females into my herd? And the other piece is breed complementarity. So how do I put breeds together that make sense? And if we're in a terminal sort of mating decision to a weaning endpoint, Brad, what's the important thing in that?
So if I'm terminal, I want to have the heterosis.
Yeah, I want pounds of calf across the scale, right? So I want to kind of put the gas or foot on the gas for growth genetics. And depending on breed, I may be able to do that more with purebreds.
Depending on what breed of cows I have and
what breed of bull I'm looking at. Yep. Yeah. And it's simple, okay? There is, I think, plenty of opportunity to go and buy hybrids or composites that fit that sort of terminal mentality. You just have to kind of look around a little more, which isn't bad. There's a lot of advantages to that because if we go back and think about the replacement female side, okay, if we have, say, two breed cross cows and the bull I'm considering is one of the breeds that's in the cows as a purebred, I lose heterosis in my cows when I do that, which we know from a reproductive standpoint.
So if I'm keeping my heifers back, that's gonna make it hard.
That's going to make it hard to use a purebred. It's probably simpler, and that's, I think, one of the big reasons that these hybrid bulls become really popular is it's sort of, I turn one bull out, he's got the crossbreeding system built in. It doesn't maximize heterosis, but kind of optimizes it, and it's really easy. So that's sort of one of the considerations and trade-offs in that sort of decision stream.
So I think that is and that's a good thought process to go through as you're considering bulls and looking down the road. So as we evaluate both hybrid, whether it's a terminal cross situation or I'm keeping the heifers, that answer may change a little bit. So this is probably a conversation that you need to have with folks, and they may be the experts in your area, the extension people, some of your veterinarians, talking to those folks to try to make those decisions.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, is get some outside input. One of the sort of misconceptions often that gets sort of promulgated as well, the hybrid bulls or the composite bulls, they don't have as good a genetic predictors as the purebred parents do. That's not true. The genetic evaluation systems today do a great job evaluating those. So maybe the key point is make sure if you're going to go out and source genetics that you buy seed stock, right? So it's not a crossbred bull. It's a seed stock hybrid bull that has genetic documentation, genomics, the whole nine yards behind him. That's a lot different than, picking up a crossbred bull at the sale barn.
But I like the idea of getting some outside opinions. And if you wonder how to start that conversation, if you go in and say, this breed is better than all the others, I bet you'll spark some conversation.
Absolutely.
So people
So we get them lit up.
Exactly. You'll get people started. So as we go into fall, one of the things, we're going to go to our BCI Cattle Chat checklist on things we want to get ready prior to the time that we wean the calves.
Well, I think with some of the market volatility recently, number eight certainly has to be your marketing plan. So make some plans, figure out what timeline you're working against.
Absolutely. Number seven is check your fences. And that could be if we're weaning in a pen or if we're going to wean in the pasture, make sure my electric fence is working.
Yep. Number six, a little bit of a nutrition plan if you're thinking about doing some either preconditioning, so kind of getting calves bunk broke pre-weaning, or doing a little kind of backgrounding exercise post-weaning. Spend some time to sort out kind of what you've got available in terms of nutrient resources and what you might need to source in.
Number five follows the nutritional plan in that I need to order the feed, whatever I'm going to get, so that I've got it on hand. And I may want to start a little bit of that with the calves beforehand to get them used to it.
Yep, great. Number four, sit down and have a conversation with your vet. Kind of work through your plan. Just make sure you haven't missed something. Get your vet on board. You may need some scripts or be prepared in case you have some BRD or something like that happen, that you're ready and prepared for appropriate treatment schedules.
Number three, after I get my plan for processing those calves and ties into both marketing and my health plan, order my vaccines and any other health supplies I might need.
Yep. Number two, check your processing facility. So make sure everything's in shape. You've got all the equipment you need and it's in good repair. So when you process calves, you can do that so it's safe for both the handler and the animals.
Number one, weaning facilities, and this is beyond just the fence. Think about, where's the water? Do I have the right source of water? Am I going to have enough of it? Do I have the bunks? Are we ready to go? Do I have all the equipment to feed? So those are our top eight things to get ready for our fall weaning season. As we think about, and we talked about things we want to get ready, but I want to talk a little bit specifically about handling those calves and the working facilities. So we know I'm going to have to get the working facilities ready. Any tips or tricks thinking about, I'm going to wean my calves here in a few weeks, what can I do to make that process easier?
Yeah, great question, Brad. I think one of the really simple things to do is, for many of us, really since maybe breeding season, if we had an AI and synchronization program, maybe last weaning season might have been the last time that we really extensively used our working facilities. You know, I suspect many places are like mine at home, a little grown up with weeds and so forth.
It's almost time to harvest that ragweed.
Ragweed and pigweed and all that, sunflowers. And so, you know, spending a little time actually just kind of sprucing up the place goes a long ways. Counting on the cattle to trample it down's maybe not the best strategy.
But everyone has had that thought.
Everyone's had that thought. I think one of the really key things is walk through the facility and figure out, okay, we forgot about, you know, there's these two boards that broke last year when we were preg checking cows. When you get those fixed, make sure there's not any, you know, physical obstructions or things that are going to injure animals, you know, nails and bolts sticking out and broken pipes and that kind of stuff. So
yeah, and I think the flooring is critical, which often we forget about because we're stomping through in boots and you've got some thick soles on there, but make sure there's no nails that have come out. If it's a solid flooring, that there's no place they're going to scuff, hurt a hoof, and also the exit from the chute, don't forget about that, because you want a non-slip area. If they're coming off outside, it's not concrete, great. If they're coming off inside or it's on a concrete pad, be sure that it is not going to, nobody's going to fall down as they go through. Because the cows have been through this system before, and hopefully they're used to it. This may be the calves' first trip through.
Yep, and they might go really fast.
they might go really fast. So yep. I think that's part of it. The other thing, it's a good time to refresh, and we talked some about BQA last week, but a good time to refresh all of your BQA information. So there's a lot of good information there on cattle handling, low stress handling, and I think you said it last time we talked about this, slower is faster. So we go slower to make the work go faster for the day. Nobody gets excited.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, Brad. And one that I think will help too is this time of year, you know, oftentimes, you know, producers of kind of medium to larger size might have a bunch of day labor in, and, you know, some of that surely is folks that you've used before. But I think, you know, it's useful to start off the day with a conversation about how our expectations of the way things are going to go in terms of animal handling.
This is how we do things here.
This is how we do things here.
You may work other places, but this is how we do things here.
And I think that's completely appropriate, and I'm reminded because we did some stuff with cattle over the weekend, and I wanted things done a certain way, and my teenage daughter said, well, you should have told me that.
You were working with your kids.
You should have told me that before, and I'm like, you know what? You're right. I should have. We should have stopped and had a little powwow beforehand about how this was going to go, and I just assumed everybody knew the way I wanted it done. So
yeah. Nothing builds bonding quite like that, or building fence, which is what we did. So we had some of the same
Yep. So spending that time sort of laying out the groundwork, and that may sort of, as you instruct people about things, it becomes clear where some of the holes might be about, oh, we need our, you know, piece of equipment over here changed, or we need to gather up some more stuff, or planning ahead part.
As you go through the process, you go through that planning. Yeah. But I think it is important because often it seems like, hey, we're weaning today and we didn't do this walkthrough.
Yep.
So
let's go.
I think it's good to plan that in advance. We appreciate you joining us this week. Had a lot of good discussion talking about different genetic decisions, some of the heritabilities. If you have a question, comment, or an idea for us to talk about on the show, please send us an email at bci@ksu.edu.